We actually have two presentations today, and the theme for both is going to be measuring ethnic and sexual identities, lessons from two studies in Central America. Today's objectives will be for you all to be able to give examples of ethnic and sexual identity related questions from these two studies, tell us how the ethnic and sexuality constructs were central to the research questions in both cases, talk about the implications for these studies' findings, and apply the lessons learned to other research efforts. The first presentation today is on ethnicity and HIV risk factors in Guatemala. We're going to talk specifically about how indigenous identity was measured and about some of the effects of that, particularly for a study of HIV risk. These pictures are, some of you are in these pictures, Giovanni if you're on the call, and John who's here with me. The pictures are from a results dissemination event that we gave after the study was complete. Sorry, John's just reminding me I didn't say who I am. This is Tori Taylor from Tulane. We are a partner, as most of you know, on measure evaluation. My other colleagues will introduce themselves when they speak. So this study in Guatemala, it came from a question that we were asked, which was, we know that indigenous Guatemalans, relative to other people in the country, are highly disadvantaged on most measures of health and well-being. Are they also at higher risk for HIV? We decided to use data that were already available, specifically the ENSMI, or the DHS, from Guatemala in 2008-2009. We looked at both the women's and the men's data sets and eventually settled on multivariate logistic regression for different ethnic groups. We'll talk about what those were in a second, on five specific factors. The factors were early sexual debut, that is before the age of 15, number of lifetime sexual partners. This was different for men and women. We used 3 or more for women and 10 or more for men, just because of the way the data broke down. Comprehensive HIV knowledge, we used the standard definition, which has to do with people's recognition of risk factors and rejection of common misconceptions. Lifetime history of HIV testing or ever having been tested, and then for men, ever having paid for sex either in kind or with cash. This presentation actually focuses more on methodological issues and implications for research in general than it does on the results, but anybody that's interested in reading the full report, that's available on the website. Jane Bertrand just entered the room with us here, and I want to acknowledge Jane's contributions also to this report. So a little bit about ethnicity in Guatemala. In Guatemala, the government recognizes what they call pueblos, or population groups, major population groups. And there are 4, Ladinos, Mayas, Xinka, and Garífuna. The Xinka and Garífuna groups are extremely small. So generally, when we deal with ethnicity in Guatemala, what we're doing is distinguishing between Mayan groups, or the so-called indigenous, and Ladinos, or what in other countries in this region are periodically referred to as mestizo as well. So 60% of the population, at least by census count, is considered Ladino. And the other 3 groups, as I said, are officially indigenous, but most of those are the Mayans. Mayans are 99% or more of the indigenous population in Guatemala. And within that, we have 23 ethno-linguistic Mayan subgroups. And they're residence is centered in the country's rural western highlands, or the Altiplano. So who is indigenous and who is Ladino? We know that ethnicity is mutable, which is to say that actually in surveys that studied the same group of people, a panel longitudinally, it can change. We also know that it's multidimensional, that it's comprised of different constructs that together make up this idea or concept that is ethnic identity or ethnicity. Regardless, most surveys and censuses use one categorical variable to measure it. It's true in the U.S., it's true in lots of other countries. The ENSME in Guatemala and the Guatemalan National Census have long, long histories of obtaining their data on ethnicity, as I said, via one variable, but rather than asking people to self-identify, they use this interviewer's observation. And that means that nothing was actually asked of the respondent. Instead, there was an item on the questionnaire saying interviewer's observation with a list of ethnic categories, and the interviewer would then classify the respondent as indigenous, Latino, or other, with a space to specify that. However, in 2008 and 2009, a self-identity question was added to the questionnaire. That left us with two measures, and it presented an interesting problem and a challenge for our research, and also the opportunity for the things I'm going to tell you about now. The question itself read like this in English. Do you consider yourself to be indigenous, Latino, or something else? It's actually really common to measure ethnicity, especially indigenous, but not race, in other countries in Latin America, too. From my research, I found out that at least one other country, Ecuador, has included both self-identity and interviewer's observation in censuses. I couldn't find other examples of a DHS that had both measures. Other countries have done this differently and in some cases used a more complex measure. Bolivia in 2001 categorized respondents as indigenous or not using a pretty complicated matrix of language and self-identity variables. So what did we get when we looked at discrepancies or concordance between these two measures in 2008 in Guatemala? We actually found pretty good concordance. 84% of women and 88% of men identified themselves the same way the interviewer did, as either indigenous or Latino. 13% of women and 8% of men self-identified as indigenous. These are the ones circled in red. But were nonetheless identified as Latino by their interviewers. Interestingly, we really didn't find cross-identification in the other direction. So there wasn't a lot of people saying, I'm Latino, and yet the interviewer saying, no, you know, you're really not. I'm going to classify you as indigenous. That really didn't happen. It was less than 2% in both the men's and women's samples. And we had a small proportion, also around 2% of cases in each sample with either other or no response on one or both of these two ethnicity variables. Stepping back for a moment, I just want to reiterate that there's long histories and broad ramifications involved here. Way back in 1950, in 1974, a study showed that as far back as the 1950 census, census enumerators had classified individuals differently on the ethnicity variable than they would classify themselves. The way they did this was to study local vital records, which they took as the gold standard. So this study went back and said, okay, how were people classified by their enumerators using their enumerator's observation, and how is that relative to the local record for that person's ethnicity from things like, you know, birth and death records? So assuming that the local record was the standard, we saw discrepancies of 4% in 1950, 16% in 1964, and always in the same direction. Moving around to other places, and more recently, in 1998 in Brazil, a study concluded that previous studies underestimated racial inequality on economic terms in the country precisely because they relied on self-classification. So these people concluded that looking at inequality, it's important to use an interviewer's observation variable rather than self-identity. Even more recently, and closer to home for some of us, there's some interesting work from 2011 showing that coroners in the United States who are classifying the decedent's race without other information tend to be affected by the cause of death in that classification, so that non-racial characteristics were shaping official statistics in the United States. And this produced some things that you might expect. So causes of death that are more common, for example, in African Americans, specifically gunshot wounds, were overly attributed. The people who died from gunshot wounds were overly considered to be African American by the coroners. In other words, the discrepancy was even greater based on classification by the coroner. And the gold standard or comparison in this case was the decedent's relatives. So they went back and asked people's next of kin did this person identify as white, African American, something else? So why is this so important? Why did we care? And specifically, why does it matter in Guatemala? Well, broadly speaking, the different dimensions of ethnicity probably have different effects on HIV risk or whatever your outcome of interest is. Just like the conclusion from the study in Brazil, it might be that when we're looking at HIV or something else, one or the other measure is really more appropriate and useful. From a quality and measurement perspective, the validity and reliability of these questions might be different. One or the other might actually be a better or higher quality measure in these terms. Perhaps most importantly, our conclusions about the size of a population or a population group and about its vulnerability can really affect program and policy decisions, including resource allocation. And I want to point out that the government of Guatemala has a policy officially supporting the use of ethnic self-determination. So that's important too, and you know, depending on the political context, the use of one or the other or even a different set of measures might be really important. The DHS data that use self-identity are not directly comparable with earlier results, so that's another thing to think about when you're trying to choose. That's the main reason that official reports in Guatemala continue to use and present the interviewer's observation. If you look at the report for this data set, you won't find mention of this issue, and in fact, to know which measure was used, you have to do the analysis, as we did. Before I get specific about the results in Guatemala, I just came across another interesting example about measurement issues and ethnicity and wanted to highlight it, and also one from the U.S. So Bolivia had a national census at the end of 2012, and it made the news because the categories for ethnicity included 40 indigenous groups and Afro-Bolivian, but did not allow respondents to indicate that they identified as mestizos. And as many as one in three Bolivians typically identifies as mestizo, so this was considered important, and people figured that it had a political basis and could have political ramifications. This is some graffiti that started appearing in La Paz, the capital, and it reads, "I'm not Aymara, I'm not Quechua, these are the largest indigenous groups there, I am mestizo." So people were really up in arms about that. Here's another cartoon from a newspaper where the guy is sweeping mestizos under the rug. And finally, a cartoon showing a couple who apparently live in a city who've covered up their big apartment building with a scene showing them to live more in a village. And on the side, the gentleman at the camera is asking, "Do you have access to clean drinking water, you know, electric energy, cable TV or internet?" And they're saying no. Critics had suggested that the decision was calculated to protect Evo Morales's presidency, and people were afraid of sort of expropriation of assets, so apparently tended to underreport. Another example quickly from the U.S. It surprised me when I saw this census form using this antiquated term Negro to describe Black Americans. And I wondered, you know, why on earth the Census Bureau would risk offending people by using a politically incorrect, offensive, antiquated term in its questionnaire. And apparently, qualitative research conducted prior to the survey showed that there was a large enough contingent of mostly rural Southern African Americans who continued to identify with and use this term. So, fearing that people who didn't see the term there wouldn't know how to identify themselves or would misidentify themselves, they left it on. But actually, as you can see from the quote at the top, very, very recently, in 2013, they decided that it no longer makes sense to use it. And I think there was some outcry that probably led to that. Before 1960 in the U.S., census takers also chose the category, ethnic category, for people they were counting. But by 1970, we had self-identification in place here. Returning to Guatemala, we've got these two measures. There's a discrepancy between them, and we asked ourselves if cross-identified respondents should be considered indigenous or Latino in the analysis of HIV risk factors. Another way of saying that would be, what matters more, people's self-identity or the interviewer's observation? We did some preliminary analyses, and it turned out that for making broad general conclusions, regardless of how its members were identified, the indigenous group had lower odds on sexual risk factors, they were less likely to have comprehensive HIV prevention knowledge, and less likely to have ever had an HIV test. So the sort of generic conclusions were the same either way. And it might be because although these groups were sizable, you know, they really weren't that big, so placing them with one group or the other didn't change the ultimate conclusion. But it was true that ethnicity showed stronger effects on HIV risk factors using the interviewer's observation. So if we look just at the differences, the actual values were a little bit stronger, it's just that the conclusions weren't changed. And in addition, we were really interested in this group, these cross-identified respondents. We felt like they presented us with the unique opportunity to better understand measurement effects in this data set, in this country, and also more broadly. So this is what we were left with, three categories instead of two. And we spent a long time figuring out where to put them in the first two groups, the first and third, and ultimately realized we could just keep them separate. So here they are, people across the top, who are identified on both variables as indigenous. And the second category, the so-called cross-identified, were identified by interviewers as Latinos and by themselves as indigenous. And then the third category, the Latinos on either measure. We did remove those 2% of respondents with an other or no response on either variable. So here are some findings. I'm going to highlight just a couple of them. On nearly every outcome, Latino and cross-identified groups were comparably and significantly different from the indigenous respondents. So that means that our cross-identified group, who self-identified as indigenous, they really sort of look like Latinos to us. They act like Latinos on the measures that we studied. In these examples, the odds for ever having had an HIV test a little more than 2 times higher for Latino women compared to indigenous women, and almost 2.5 times higher for cross-identified women compared to indigenous women. And you can see that the limits are pretty comparable. The odds of having comprehensive HIV knowledge were more than 1.5 times higher for Latino men compared to indigenous men, and we see a marginal difference between the cross-identified men and indigenous men. And again, feel free to seek out the full report on the website if you're interested in detail in those results. An article from 2005 called Conceptualizing and Categorizing Race and Ethnicity in Health Services Research points out that the strength of the relationship between ethnicity and health outcomes is influenced by so-called acculturation, or the extent to which members of a group adopt the beliefs and practices of another group. I thought this was interesting because our results really echo the conclusion. The indigenous population becomes sort of Latinoized if we use self-identification to define group membership. And the effect of that is really to reduce demographic and risk factor differences between the groups. Other studies have opted, especially in the US, and studies that are looking specifically at how to measure ethnicity, to measure acculturation directly using a number of scales that have been variously validated. I think that's something that we might want to consider if this becomes of interest in countries like Guatemala or Bolivia with large ethnic and indigenous populations. Some conclusions. Guatemalans construct their own ethnic self-identities that are not reliably predicted by the interviewer's observation, but I think we might have a place for both of them in ENSME and other health research. Using the self-identity measure, the new one, could introduce the estimated size of the indigenous population in this country by up to 13%. I think that's pretty significant, and I think there are some folks in Guatemala who agree with us. Specifically on HIV risk, the ethnic self-identity measure has clear potential to increase estimates of risk, primarily because of this acculturation among the group that's cross-identified, so self-identified indigenous, who otherwise have been left out of reporting on indigenous groups. A few more conclusions. We feel like the choice of measure could have even more profound implications for analyses that are looking at ethnic differences on other outcomes. And also, if this cross-identified group grows, the measurement effects for HIV risk and other factors would be even more substantial. I think it's going to be interesting to look at these data for the next ENSME survey round, which is going into the field this spring, just to see what's happening with the population, this cross-identified group. Is it a greater proportion overall? Is it smaller? Is it about the same? Does it look the same on demographic factors? I hope and suggest that researchers will consider investing in formative research in question design phases, especially for big studies like the ENSME, which are used a lot in policy and programming. And also remember to engage the indigenous communities themselves in this work. And by formative research in question design, I really mean things like cognitive interviews or focus groups to explore issues that have been underexplored in the past and where maybe we don't have a lot of evidence yet about the validity and reliability of the questions or question sets. And finally, some next steps. We were really pleased to hear from our colleagues in Guatemala that the Presidential Commission Against Indigenous Racism and Discrimination is already holding meetings to talk about the findings from this study and its implications for measuring ethnicity in the ENSME and other national efforts. The ENSME that's coming up is probably going to include both measures again, and I'm involved in a large-scale program evaluation in the Western Highlands, a largely Mayan area that's going to include both also, and has incorporated some specific ethnic marker questions on language and the use of traditional dress that can also be explored. Analyzing these types of data could help us identify the questions or sets of questions that have high construct validity and help us best distinguish these groups on health outcomes, which is really our ultimate goal. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to my colleagues. I think we're going to hold questions to the end. Thanks very much for your attention.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Catherine Andrianopoulos. Thank you, Tori, for introducing our studies and the presentation today. I'm going to present on a study that we conducted in El Salvador titled Health Service Utilization Among Men Who Have Sex with Men and Transgender Women. And similar to Tori, rather than focusing on the specific findings related to our study objectives per se, we're going to focus more on measurements and some of the things that we did to look at gender identity and sexual orientation as distinct constructs within this study. And today I'm going to be presenting with my colleague John Hembling. We conducted this study together with the support of the USAID Regional Office and El Salvador's Ministry of Health. So before we begin, I think it would be helpful to touch briefly on the health of sexual minorities and how historically these populations have been addressed within the field of public health. I'm actually going to just put all the bullets up for right now. We now know that sexual minorities suffer from higher rates of depression, substance abuse, suicide ideation, and HIV and other sexually transmitted infections. However, in the field of public health, we have been relatively slow to address the needs of this population, partly because homosexuality was actually classified as a mental disorder until 1973 in the DSM. After this time, afterwards, when it was no longer classified as a mental disorder, there was an apprehension to address the mental health needs of this population, which are in large part due to experiences of stigma, because of a fear of aligning homosexuality in particular with a mental disorder. However, this began to change when the HIV epidemic came about in the mid-1980s and had a particularly devastating impact on homosexual men. The increased vulnerability of the disease among gay men led to a public perception that this was a gay disease, which was actually at one time referred to as GRID, or gay-related immunodeficiency syndrome. The fact that HIV was also a stigmatized condition led to the double stigmatization of the gay community, which now also incurred the illness-related stigma of HIV. And so in an effort to try and reduce this, what was done was that rather than focus on this population as a group, the behavior itself that was transmitting the infection became what the group was labeled as. And so was born the term men who have sex with men. I want to talk about this term just a little bit more and define it. As I mentioned, MSM is a population that has emerged from HIV research and practice. It is a way to define a group based on a high-risk behavior rather than a sexual orientation. Within the category of MSM, you may have many different types of sexual orientation. So by focusing on the behavior, it became a more inclusive kind of umbrella term. This could include homosexual, gay, bisexual, heterosexual, among others. So now this term allows for the inclusion of men who don't identify as gay or homosexual but might also have sex with other men. And so examples would be gay-identified men, heterosexual men who have sex with men or other men, bisexual men, or male sex workers, regardless of their sexual orientation. Another category within the group of this larger umbrella term of MSM are transgender persons. A transgender person is a separate population that has been typically lumped under the term MSM, and this has caused concern in the community, and it was a concern when we were trying to address the study objectives of our particular study. So just to go over a few definitions, a transgender person is someone whose gender identity differs from their biological sex, which is assigned to them at birth. Assigned biological sex is different than gender. Gender is defined as what society believes about the appropriate roles, duties, rights, responsibilities, and accepted behaviors and opportunities and status of men and women in relation to one another. It is something that is socially constructed, which implies its meaning is produced and reproduced by members of the society living together, who through their interaction and interpretation of their culture reproduce its meaning on a continuous basis. Thus, gender is not something that is as a fact, but is something that is performed continuously and dynamic. It is something that is ascribed to somebody within their culture, assumed based on their biological sex, but not necessarily always congruent. Gender identity is a personal sense of being a man, a woman, or something different, regardless of your sexual orientation. So this is different than what I was talking about before, which relates more to who you are attracted to sexually and your own sex. It is a term. It is something that relates to your gender identity, not who you have sex with. A transgender woman is a common term for people born biologically male with female identification or expression. Okay, I'm going to turn it over to John.
Well, this is John Hembling. It is in this broader context and debate around MSM and inclusive groups that USAID's Central American Regional HIV/AIDS program requested that Measure Evaluation conduct a health service utilization study among MSM in San Salvador, El Salvador. Just a brief bit of background, the HIV epidemic in El Salvador is concentrated based on statistics from 2008 and additional statistics, among men who have sex with men, transgender women, and sex workers. We know from the 2008 biological and behavior study that HIV prevalence was about 10.8% among MSM, and that figure included transgender women. When they did a convenient sample of transgender women that they broke out from the larger sample, they found a prevalence of about 25% of HIV among transgender women. So we faced a challenge when conceptualizing our study. Do we include or exclude transgender women from our study? After 2008's HIV prevalence study, the biological and behavioral surveillance study that I mentioned, transgender groups strongly advocated for trans women-specific data. They didn't want to be considered a subgroup of MSM that could not be disaggregated from the results, and they wanted to be able to say something about their policy or about their population for advocacy, programming, funding, etc. We knew, though, that we also did not have sufficient funding to do two separate studies, one specifically among health service utilization among MSM, and one specifically for transgender women. And we spent a considerable amount of time dealing with this dilemma. And we ultimately, as you can see by the cover shot of the report, decided to include both men who have sex with men and transgender women in our study population. We felt that we didn't want to exclude such a highly vulnerable group, transgender women, from the study. From previous studies, we knew that transgender women were highly socially connected to men who have sex with men in San Salvador and could be captured in a respondent-driven sampling sample. And then we knew that we may not have enough transgender women in our sample to be able to disaggregate potentially, but we were coordinating very closely with the USAID's 8-STAR-1 program or project study that was focusing on health service use among transgender women specifically in San Salvador, and they were using a mixed methods approach. So for us, since we made the decision to include them, our question became, how do we include MSM and transgender women as part of our study? Our study was designed to describe past year health service utilization, including general health and HTI, STI services. It was designed to identify factors that may influence health service utilization, including experiences of discrimination from healthcare providers. So we first decided that we need to confront the issue of representing each population adequately or appropriately in the study. And we made efforts to ensure that we were explicitly accounting for transgender women in our study population by reaching out and gathering input from the transgender women organizations and our own field team, which was very diverse in terms of sexual identity, gender identity, et cetera. Developing eligibility criteria and survey questions that were inclusive of transgender women. We included a transgender woman as part of our interviewer team. And we included a transgender woman as one of our seeds, which was important for the recruitment process that we did under respondent-driven sampling. The second issue that we faced was about measuring the constructs appropriately in the study, so as not to generalize experiences from one group with another, wrongly attributing findings to both groups, or to miss findings important within each group. So we made, again, efforts to reach out to the transgender women organizations, sharing our tools, gathering input about the proper way to ask these questions and what people would understand and how they would respond from their point of view. And then importantly, we measured gender identity and sexual orientation as separate measures, as separate questions, and we'll go into detail about that moving forward.
Okay, so now I'm going to give you an example of how we reframed our eligibility criteria to be inclusive of both MSM and transgender women. And this is particularly important in a respondent-driven sampling study where it is your own participants who are actually recruiting other participants. And so communicating to them the eligibility criteria gives them an idea of the target population and who they should consider part of their social network within that target population that would then be eligible for the study. So first I'm going to share with you the eligibility criteria from the 2008 Biological and Behavioral Surveillance Study that was conducted a few years before ours. And in this one, in addition to other eligibility criteria like age and having been in San Salvador for a certain amount of time, was being a man who had anal sex with another man in the last 12 months. So this is what they communicated to participants about who else would be eligible to be in the study. And in this study, as we'll show in a minute, they did have some participation among transgenders, but the actual criteria said a man who had anal sex with another man in the last 12 months. In our study, we broadened this to include a man or transgender woman who had anal sex, receptive or penetrative, with another man or transgender woman in the last 12 months. So you can see that we added transgender woman specifically here. I'm also going to give a few examples of questions that we brought in to include the term transgender woman, whereas before maybe they would have just said MSM. So for example, the last time you had an HIV test, did the provider have sufficient knowledge about the health needs of men who have sex with men or transgender women? Approximately how many people know that you form sexual relationships with men or transgender women? This one being interested more in disclosure, or not particularly disclosure, but their perception of how many people knew about their identity or sexual orientation. So, to review, we asked separate questions to measure gender identity and sexual orientation. In many HIV studies and concentrated epidemic settings, transgender women have been included as a subgroup of MSM populations, and this is important in concentrated epidemics like in Central America, where previously it's just been a single question. And that gender identity is one's personal sense of gender and of being a man or a woman or something different, while sexual orientation is one's erotic or emotional attraction to another person. So you can see the different kinds of categories that fall under each domain, and these are not equal with each other.
Looking at the, again, reflecting on the 2008 Biological and Behavioral Surveillance Survey that was conducted in El Salvador, you can see that they asked it in this way. Sexually, how do you identify yourself? Heterosexual, bisexual, gay, homosexual, transvestite, transsexual, transgender, or other? This form of the question makes the selection of one's gender identity and sexual orientation mutually exclusive. So if you chose that you were transgender, you didn't have an option of picking or choosing a sexual orientation. You had to pick one in there. And this is a common way in which, in many studies, this has been asked. It was asked in the region as well in 2009, 2010 in the Nicaragua Biological and Behavior Surveillance Study, and is a common way that these questions get asked. In terms of the 2011 measure study looking at health service utilization, we asked two separate questions. Again, these questions we ran by our research team, which was composed of gay, bisexual men, transgender women, heterosexual women, heterosexual men, locally, as well as the international team, as well as with transgender groups that we were working with. In terms of sexual orientation, we asked, in terms of your sexual orientation, how do you identify? And they had categories. They weren't read the categories. They chose the categories. We then asked in a separate question, what is your gender identity? And in this case, we did read the questions. In our results, as you will see, comparing to the 2008 Biological and Behavior Surveillance Study on the left, our study had about twice as many transgender women compared to the 2008 study. So we found about 18.5% of our sample, this is the weighted data, was self-identified as transgender women, compared to 9.1% of the 2008 study. And it is possible that there are more transgender women in our study because of the explicit inclusion of transgender women in the eligibility criteria. So it was clear that transgender women were specifically, could be included under this study. And it's also possible that there are more transgender women in our study because we measured gender identity separate from sexual orientation. So people were allowed to choose both, and they didn't have to pick either one. And you'll see in the next slide, when you look at sexual orientation by gender identity, excuse me, we see that among MSM, the vast majority, 43% self-identified as gay or homosexual, and 52% self-identified as bisexual, while only 4.7%, close to 5%, self-identify as heterosexual. Under transgender women, you see the vast majority, 81% of our sample, self-identified as heterosexual. So if a transgender woman had to choose between self-identifying as trans or self-identifying as heterosexual, she may have chosen heterosexual. So you may see inflated numbers of what would be considered heterosexual MSM in previous studies or in other studies, and fewer transgender women. That is a possibility. We don't know for sure, but that might be what is going on. And that could be important because heterosexual MSM are considered a very hard-to-reach population. Very important as a potential bridge population for the spread of the HIV epidemic.
So having a larger category of people that were identified as transgender women in our sample allowed us to be able to look at the results and compare them between transgender women and MSM groups. So I want to share with you some of the results that we found that were actually different between transgender women and MSM. So we see here medical insurance and having a regular health care provider by gender identity, and that MSM had more medical insurance, were more likely to have more medical insurance and a regular health care provider compared to transgender women. The next slide talks about experiences of discrimination. So we asked participants a series of questions about whether or not they had ever experienced this form of discrimination when they had sought health care. And we can see that there are several places where transgender women reported experiencing more types of discrimination from healthcare providers than MSM did. I'll point out one in particular, 74% of transgender women reported being refused health services because of their gender identity or sexual orientation, compared to 55% of MSM. In addition to the health service use variables, we wanted to share a few variables related to social vulnerability among the two groups. We see here that homelessness was actually higher among MSM, compared to transgender women in the last 6 months. So more MSM reported being homeless at least one night in the last 6 months. Whereas transgender women were more likely to report having ever been incarcerated or having engaged in sex work than MSM. So 53.4% of transgender women reported engaging in sex work, while only 29% of MSM did. One of the findings that we were surprised about, and actually led to some really interesting discussion during our dissemination conference, was that MSM and transgender women were equally likely to report abuse or maltreatment due to their sexual orientation in the last 12 months. And we defined in the survey abuse or maltreatment, and this was read out to the participant, as hitting, punching, kicking, threats, scolding, or experiencing humiliations due to your sexual orientation. And I think this is important because it starts to tease out some of maybe the different experiences or that stigma might be experienced differently between the two groups. And that is what came out from some of our discussion. Whereas transgender women's stigma is visible, depending on whether or not they are expressing their gender or dressing in their gender identity, they may experience stigma differently because people can see that. And so it becomes part of their constantly part of their interactions on a daily basis. For MSM, there's the internalized form of stigma that still exists, where people are trying to perhaps manage their stigma. And so having to choose in what opportunities to disclose or not disclose, and having that be something that constantly forms part of their relationships. And so the idea that stigma was actually, and maltreatment, was something that was, from the participants' view, important in both of their lives. Was something that was, I think, important for both the transgender and the MSM groups to be able to discuss together. So in conclusion, I think framing the eligibility criteria, the composition of the field team, and diversity in seeds for RDS can achieve a larger proportion of transgender women as part of MSM studies, or at least categorized more appropriately as transgender women when they are part of the study. And distinguishing between gender identity and sexual orientation as separate constructs is a more accurate measurement technique and allowed for a more nuanced understanding of the needs of each subgroup, as you saw with the few findings that we presented. So.
We wanted to give a special thanks to the USAID Guatemala office, as well as the USAID Central American Regional HIV/AIDS program for providing support that made both studies possible. I think now we're ready to open it up for questions. You can either ask for a verbal question if you have a microphone, or type in your question to into the text box. Don't be shy. Are there any questions? Yeah, we have a question here from Jane Bertrand, who's in the room with us.
My question is, what has been the response from the people doing the next nationally representative survey in Guatemala in terms of how they're going to use this information? Have the people that did the last one reacted, and is there any decision as to what the next one will be?
I do know that there have been discussions about it, and I know that the ENDSME round that's about to go into the field is most likely going to include at least these two measures. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, I don't have information, but I wonder if our colleagues in the USAID Guatemala office or others that might have information about this could let us know what they might know.
There have been a series of workshops that were conducted, I think, as Tori mentioned, around the country to disseminate this information closely to the different indigenous groups, as well as to kind of generate conversation about measuring ethnicity and what does it mean. I think an interesting point is that, as Tori made, that you find a large percentage of group is self-identifying one way, yet that makes them more Latino in other senses. So you see different effects of that. We have a message from USAID Guatemala that they will discuss the new technical team managing ENSME, how to measure ethnicity. Are there any other comments or questions?
I have more of a comment to congratulate you all on separating the gender and the sexual orientation, and the results on whether or not you've experienced abuse related to your sexual orientation are interesting results, but I would like to see in future surveys that you tease that out more, whether or not you've experienced abuse, and whether or not you see that as related to your sexual orientation or in your gender transition. Because I think from the little bit of program work that I have done with transgender women, they would answer no to that question.
They would answer no to?
They would answer no to that question, not necessarily related to their sexual orientation.
I think the actual question was sexual orientation or gender identity.
Was it?
Yeah.
Okay.
We included both in the actual question.
And I think it would be important to just ask whether or not you've experienced abuse, mm-hmm. period. Because making that connection for yourself in an interview like that, that it has to do with either your gender transition or your sexual orientation, it may not be relevant to them necessarily internally.
We did see also, in terms of ever experiencing forced sex or being, mm-hmm. A victim of sexual violence, mm-hmm. You do see that more transgender women have been a victim of sexual or of sexual violence. In the numbers, they're overlapping confidence intervals, so we couldn't mm-hmm. necessarily say that they were mm-hmm. separate, but you do see some differences.
Right, and that's not to discount that gay men experience a lot of abuse within their relationships that is not talked about. But I think just simply asking the question without relationship to something would be important.
One of the other things that we want to do, I don't know if the mic is close enough, what would be done in future studies is one of the measures that we did include here was internalized homonegativity, mm-hmm. Apart from abuse, but to get at this form of internal stigma and how that's being internalized and may affect behavior. And that's been actually a very strong predictor, several of our outcomes. Now, one of the things that when we were wanting to include transgender women's experience in this more, one of the things we were limited on was having an internalized measure of transsexual kind of negativity. Which has not been explored as much in the literature. There aren't as many, I didn't find any standardized scales. There might be one out there, but there was much more around internalized homonegativity. And so there aren't really good measures at this point to see how transgender people are internalizing their larger kind of group norms. And so I think that is definitely an area for future exploration.
We've got a comment up on the screen from USAID Guatemala noting that meetings are also forthcoming with the National Statistics Institute to discuss the ethnicity measurement issue. I think that's great and really important because that widely cited statistic about 60% of Guatemalans being Latino actually comes from census data. So the use of one measure or the other for the census could really shift the balance of the indigenous population above or below 50% if the differences are on par with what we've seen in the ENSME. Thanks for that comment, guys.
We have a question from Amaya. Were questions regarding engaging in risky health behaviors for sexual identity study looked at, and how did gender versus sexual orientation impact patients seeking out health services? I'll speak to the kind of sexual risk behavior. There was more engagement in sex exchange, like we presented here, among transgender women than among MSM. There were actually higher rates of HIV knowledge and I think it was HIV testing among transgender women than among MSM.
Yeah, and in terms of patients seeking out health services, when we included these variables in our multivariate models, both sexual orientation and gender identity actually didn't hang in that analysis and weren't influential in health service utilization in general sense or HIV testing. However, we did see that in these, for example, these bivariate relationships that we were showing, that in terms of health insurance coverage or access to health insurance, having a regular provider, MSM were more likely to have access to those than transgender women. Are there any additional questions? We have another comment. So we were asked if we have it, are we hoping to continue either of these activities in year six? If so, any ideas on what might it look like moving forward?
Well, one of the things that we're working on now is looking at the same data set that we have for the health service use study in El Salvador and looking at some other kind of analyses that weren't presented specifically in the report, because there are a lot of variables related to social vulnerability, internalized homonegativity, larger kind of poverty and SES measures that we wanted to look at among the population. That's ongoing work with USAID now.
In terms of the ethnicity study, we are not really working on the HIV risk factor analyses at this time, but the issue, as I think I mentioned, has been raised in another study that I'm involved with that's called the Western Highlands Integrated Program Evaluation. That will go into the field probably in April, and it is a large-scale five-year program evaluation in mostly Mayan areas of the Western Highlands. So we are definitely going to incorporate both ethnicity measures into those questionnaires as well as these other markers of ethnic identity that I talked about.
We have an additional question from Amaya. Did more access to health services among MSM have to do with variables related to socioeconomic indicators?
Yes, well, one in particular. So we had three categories of income: people that had no monthly income, people that had up to $250 a month per income, and then $250 or more. And having any income versus none was related to seeking health services. So that one in particular was.
Additionally, having access to health insurance, which may be an economic, socioeconomic variable that you could consider, was also makes sense, right? That if you have health insurance, you're probably more likely to seek out services as well. Those were some of the indicators that hung in there for health service utilization.
Thank you, Amaya, for the question. And also to remind everyone that there are links to both studies and the full reports and findings on this presentation, but also on the MEASURE website.
The health service utilization study is up in Spanish at this point, and we're in the final processing of formatting the English version. So we can also send that out, and that should be available shortly on the MEASURE website.
The HIV study is available in Spanish and English.
And I think in both reports, we include our full surveys. So you can see that if you wanted those questions for any research that you're doing.
Okay. So we're at the hour mark. I think we would just, as a group, like to say thank you for your attention and present and being present and asking some interesting questions. If you have additional questions, you can email any one of us.